Hello, I'm Veronica Scarsbrick, and I'd like you to join our guest today, a professor of liturgy at the Pontifical Institute of Liturgy of St. Joseph's Abbey in Louisiana in the United States. He's Abbot Patrick Regan, and he was kind enough to join me here at our studios and answer my questions relating to the Good Friday liturgy, which in the 20th century has somewhat of a milestone dating back to the papacy of Pope Pius XII. But let's find out more from Abbot Regan. There's a moment in history when there was a particular liturgical reform. It was in the 20th century with Pius XII. Is that correct?
Yes.
Did I do my homework right?
That was a major turning point in the liturgical movement. In 1951, Pius XII restored the Paschal Vigil, and that was so successful that 5 years later, he reformed the rest of Holy Week. And, of course, one of the highlights of Holy Week is Good Friday. And so he made two significant changes in the Good Friday liturgy. One was the time. Before Pius XII, these liturgies of Holy Thursday, Good Friday, Holy Saturday were celebrated early in the morning at about the time when you had weekday masses, 6:30, 7 o'clock. Very few people attended. He wanted, of course, to encourage active participation of the faithful in these central mysteries of our redemption. And so he changed the time of the Thursday liturgy from the morning until the evening, and then the same for the Friday liturgy from early in the morning until mid-afternoon, roughly 3 o'clock, though it could be later for pastoral reasons. And the second change was that he permitted the faithful to receive Holy Communion. Up until this time, only the priest received in what was popularly called the Mass of the Pre-Sanctified, very mysterious, but only the priest received, and again, with a view to active participation of the faithful in the sacred mysteries, Pius XII permitted everyone worthy to commune on this day.
These changes you mentioned stemmed from the 1950s, but Pius X had already started bringing reforms to the liturgy, hadn't he?
Yes.
He was a great liturgist, wasn't he?
Sure. Especially his famous motu proprio called, in Italian, Tra le sollecitudini. In English, it's usually called his motu proprio on sacred music. It was very interesting because basically what he was opposed to was operatic music at the liturgy, which left the people out. They did nothing but sit and listen, and promoted Gregorian chant, which, according to him, the faithful could sing easily. But in giving reasons for this, he said in passing that active participation in the liturgy was the primary and indispensable source of the true Christian spirit. Well, shortly after that, especially a monk of Montcésar in Belgium, Lambert Baudouin, picked up on that and then used that as the theological foundation for the faithful participating in the liturgy as the primary and indispensable source of nourishing our faith. And so Pius X was definitely a turning point in the modern liturgical movement.
Let's get back to Good Friday. Mm-hmm. What are the key liturgical moments of this particular day? It's the first day of the Triduum, isn't it?
It is the first day of the Triduum. Yes, you are correct. The Triduum is not Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, but the 1969 calendar changed it to Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So Easter Sunday is now part of the Triduum. But the Triduum begins on Thursday night, the evening mass of the Lord's Supper. So really it's best to think of the 3 days, the Triduum, as 3 nights, from Thursday night to Friday night to Saturday night to Sunday night.
So first liturgical moment of the Passion?
Well, I think the high point of the Good Friday liturgy is the reading of the Passion according to St. John. And this Passion according to John is very different from the synoptic Passions. We tend to lump them all together into a single storyline, but actually John's Passion is quite different from the other three. Particularly, there is no agony in the garden in the fourth gospel. People come to arrest Jesus, and he is the protagonist. He says, "Whom do you seek?" and then he introduces himself, I am he. There's no Simon of Cyrene in the fourth gospel. Jesus carries his own cross. Before Pilate, Jesus is not silent as a lamb before the shearers, Isaiah said. Not silent before Pilate, but rather he enters into a lengthy dialogue with Pilate. In many respects, turns out to be a kind of a discourse about his mission. For this was I born, for this have I come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. And Pilate scoffs at that, indifferent to the truth, and yet paradoxically he proclaims it unwittingly because he orders this inscription to be placed above the head of Jesus, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. And though he admits that he's indifferent to the truth, paradoxically he proclaims the truth of who Jesus is. Finally, or rather next to last, Jesus' dying words are not, my God, why hast thou forsaken me, as in Mark and Matthew, or even into your hands I commend my spirit, as in Luke, but in Latin, consummatum est, which would best be translated, it is consummated, namely, my work, my mission, all that the Father gave me to do has now reached its point of consummation fulfillment. Catherine of Siena has a lovely commentary, reflection on these dying words of Jesus. She says,
in great joy he called out, consummatum est. And though that word sounded sorrowful, there was joy consumed and a flame in the fire of divine charity. It is as if the sweet Jesus wanted to say, I have consummated and fulfilled what is written of me. The painful desire I had to buy back the human race is achieved. Therefore do I rejoice and exult.
It's a wonderful reflection on the attitude of Jesus at the moment of his death and, which might seem strange to us, the joy that he experienced when we tend to portray all of this as very sorrowful. Finally, a unique characteristic of the passion in the Gospel of John is that immediately after his death, his side is pierced and from it issue blood and water. In the Bible, blood and water are both symbols of life. And so the deed of this soldier intended to verify that Jesus was truly dead actually accomplishes just the opposite. It reveals him to be living and life-giving. So it's in view of the passion as presented by John that we can go immediately to the adoration of the cross as a tree of life. This gesture of exposing and adoring the cross on Good Friday began in Jerusalem. We know of it in the late 4th century from the famous pilgrim Egeria, who kept a diary and described it. In Jerusalem, the cross was exposed and adored all morning long, from 8 in the morning until noon. And then from noon until 3 o'clock, there was a service of the word in which everything in the Bible that spoke about the redemptive death of Jesus was read. But by the 8th century, this custom of venerating the cross on Good Friday had come to Rome and takes two forms. One is the papal liturgy, which began with a long procession from St. John Lateran, where the Pope lived at that time, to Santa Croce in Jerusalem. And in that procession, a deacon carried the relic of the cross, and the Pope walked in front of it with a censer. Arriving at Santa Croce, they then read the Passion of John, and the intercessions that we still know. In parochial churches, things were a little bit different. They did the readings first, then the long intercessions, and concluded with the exposition and veneration of the cross, followed by communion. When all of this Roman liturgy traveled north of the Alps, in the 8th and 9th century, a new element was added, the veiling of the cross. And so now this part of the liturgy begins with the unveiling of the cross and the acclamation, "Behold the wood of the cross on which hung the salvation of the world." And then everybody gets a chance to go up and kiss the cross.
That unveiling is something that used to be more common, no?
Usually it's done in three steps. I mean, unveiling one of the arms of the cross, and then the head, and then finally the whole thing. And at each moment of this progressive unveiling is sung, "Behold the wood of the cross on which hung the salvation of the world. Come, let us adore." And everybody answers, "Come, let us adore," repeating that.
In Latin, what would it be?
Ecce lignum crucis.
Ecce lignum crucis.
Venite adoremus. Sung three times, each time on a little higher note to kind of add to the drama of it. And then, in also still with Adoration of the Cross, are sung two pieces of chant which are very moving. The first is called the Improperia, or reproaches, in which Jesus from the cross reproaches his people for their lack of faith, saying, "O my people, what have I done for thee? Or in what have I offended thee? Answer me." And then comes a very, very moving refrain, "Holy God, Holy Mighty One, Holy Immortal One, have mercy on us." We're familiar with "Holy, Holy, Holy" from the Sanctus. In this case, each of the holies has a little phrase added to it, "Holy God, Holy Mighty One, Holy Immortal One." But it goes back to the vision of Isaiah in chapter 6. In that vision, the seraphim, it's a vision of heaven, one seated high upon the throne, surrounded by seraphim. But the seraphim veil their eyes from the sight of the one seated upon the throne because he's so other and majestic and transcendent that they dare not look upon him. What's powerful in the Good Friday Liturgy is that the Good Friday Liturgy is presenting Christ on the cross as a definitive revelation of the name of God. And so, him upon whom the seraphim dare not gaze is revealed to our sight, and we use their words to adore him, saying, "Holy God, Holy Strong One, Holy Immortal One, have mercy on us." Very powerful moment in the Good Friday Liturgy.
Right at the beginning, when we started talking, you spoke about communion and how Pius XII reintroduced that, introduced that.
Rather. That's right. Now, it's important. The communion is not something just tacked on. It kind of follows logically, if not necessarily, logically, from the rest of the liturgy. In his decree restoring the Good Friday Liturgy, the title of that decree was "The Greatest Mysteries of Our Redemption." And Pius XII said that having recalled the redemptive act of Jesus in the Passion, and having adored the trophy of redemption, which is what he called the cross, the trophy of our redemption, we now personally unite ourselves with the Redeemer in communion. So it's very powerful, the progressive from the story of redemption to the instrument of redemption, identified as a trophy, to our personal union with him who hung upon us, and thereby sharing both in his death and resurrection.
And warm thanks there to Professor of Liturgy at the Pontifical Institute of Liturgy of St. Joseph's Abbey in Louisiana in the United States. He's Abbot Patrick Regan. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening.